This evening, we're going to continue in our study of James chapter 1. We're going to be looking at his statement in verse 14 about the true source of temptation. In our studies of James, we've been looking at temptation from many, many different directions. And last week, particularly, we looked at verse 13, the exhortation that we should not attempt to put the responsibility for our temptations upon God. And the logic there is pretty simple. The word that's translated evil, as we saw last week, is a word that means to have a lack that drives you to try to fill it from the perspective of human ability and wisdom. That's evil. It's always evil to fall back on human resources and human wisdom. The having of a lack itself, in some ways, is a condition of evil because the scriptures tell us that men only have a real lack after they have departed from the light. In the presence of God, there's no such thing as a genuine lack. We'll be talking a little bit more about that this evening, but the only time men ever have a real lack is when they have strayed from the presence of God. And when men have strayed from the presence of God, it's fundamentally contradictory to think that God would tempt them, because temptation is designed to get you to stray from God. And if you've already strayed, it's impossible for you to be tempted to do that. So there's an inherent logic in verse 13 that needs to be real clear. But we didn't say very much about, and probably won't this evening either, but I do want to bring it up, and that is the fact that verse 13 indicates that in order to deal effectively with temptation, we have to be really careful that we don't get into the blame game, and especially when we move it in the direction of God. There is no hope in putting things off on Him that don't belong there. Dealing with temptation by shoving the responsibility away will not work. It just doesn't. And we're seeing it in our generation where everybody has an excuse, somebody to blame for whatever condition. And James addresses that pointedly in verse 13. It's even more difficult, though, for most people to deal with the reality that he reveals in verse 14. And that's where we really want to pursue that this evening. The real root of temptation. He says in verse 14, each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. Now, this is the antithesis to verse 13. Instead of blaming God and saying, I'm being tempted by God, in this verse, he says that temptation, well, we could say, in technically speaking, it doesn't even come from the devil. The devil made me do it is nonsense too. It's just as big a nonsense as to say God is the one who's tempting me here. There is a truth in the fact that Satan tempts, but it's a secondary truth. But I want us to think for a little bit about James's accusation that we're tempted when we're carried away by our own lust. That would mean that, technically speaking, temptation doesn't come from outside. Comes from within. Now, that wouldn't always have been true. According to Genesis 3, Adam and Eve were genuinely tempted, and it was not from within. It was from without. And the reason was because in their creation by God, He did not create them with anything that would predispose them to evil within themselves. They were created, if not leaning toward holiness, at least neutral. I mean, I don't know just how much prejudice toward holiness there was in the original creation, but I know there was no prejudice toward evil. It was at least morally neutral and perhaps weighted in the other direction. We do know that Adam and Eve's experience should have weighted them significantly in the direction of the positive, because all of their experience from the time they became conscious up until the time they had to deal with Satan's suggestions up until that time, they had had no evidence of any kind that God was anything less than what he had been presented to them as in the cool of the day as he interacted with them and in all the good that he had shown them. It's a marvel to our thinking that Satan was able to get their loyalty so easily. Maybe it wasn't as easy as Genesis 3 makes it look. The Bible doesn't record everything that was said and didn't record how much time went on or any of that. But we do know that they had nothing in terms of their experience in relation to the serpent that would have indicated that he ought to be trusted. But they had had no indication that things couldn't be trusted either.
The original temptation came from Satan, of course.
Yes.
But Eve looked at the fruit and she saw that it was desirable.
Mm-hmm.
That came from within.
Well, in her definitions. And I really believe that the reason the temptation in the garden was effective is because Satan was able to create a sense of need where there was none. And that's something we've got to really be careful about. I noticed when we were singing that song, Jesus is walking with me, you know, the middle verse says something about, I've known the weight of a cross on my shoulder. Well, I doubt that. There are very few people who can come anywhere close to what Jesus was experiencing at that point. But what we do is we magnify our troubles and minimize our blessings so that our troubles are crosses and our blessings are, well, you know, I kind of deserve that anyway, kind of thing. That's a bad approach. We ought to magnify our blessings and minimize our troubles. That'd help a lot. But at any rate, in the beginning, man was not tempted from the inside originally. Now, it is true that Satan was able to create some internal stuff, and that's why he was successful. But at the outset, the temptation came from outside. And it's also true at the temptation of Jesus that he was not carried away and enticed by his own desires. He didn't have a fallen sin nature. That's one reason he was born of a virgin. And when he went out to have this confrontation with the devil in the wilderness, he went out in the same, at least in the same moral foundation that Adam had before the fall, at least that. So James's statement here is what we call a post-fall statement. Verse 14 is after the fact. Nobody in our generation and nobody since Genesis 3 except Jesus himself escapes this internal reality. So what we want to be clear about the fact, there are certain things that are true about every believer. And James is writing to believers about temptation. The thing that we already pointed out in earlier was that temptation is always designed as a solicitation to move from fellowship with God. In the strictest sense, a person who is not in fellowship with God can't be tempted because he's already overcome with evil. I mean, he's already in the darkness. And the fact that he is subject to lusts that take him and destroy his life, that's a foregone conclusion, but they're technically not temptations because he's already in the dominion of darkness. But the point is, if temptation's objective is to get people to move away from fellowship with God, then believers are technically the only people who can be tempted. Everybody else is already under his dominion. Now, I don't mean to say by that unbelievers don't face situations that pull them against whatever residual conscience or whatever they might have. But as far as resisting that temptation, it's not going to do them any good. I mean, there's a certain amount of diminishing of evil impact by resisting those, but it's not going to recommend them to God. They're still going to perish under the judgment of God. So temptation is addressed in relation to believers, and the objective is to get us to break our fellowship with God. And, of course, if we're not walking with God, then the fellowship's already broken. But I said that to say this. Because of the fact that it's technically addressed only to believers, people who have come into the light by faith in Christ, they come, and no believer ever comes without this foundation. Number one, he has experience of his own depravity. Nobody comes to Christ without having already experienced their own selfishness and their own twisted focus on themselves. Secondly, he has experienced the reality of the darkness to some degree. Now, obviously, some people's experience is greater than others. Children who come to Christ seldom have as deep an experience in any of these things as perhaps adults that come, but they have some. And thirdly, they have already developed patterns of dealing with problems that left God out. And the problem is that we tend to fall back on the strategies that we used to use. This is the real danger point in parents not making their kids obey them and make them mind, teach them the value of obedience through discipline and reward and all that kind of thing, because children are masters from the word go at trying to manipulate things to get their way. And we only get better at it as time goes by. Adults are fully developed masters at it. But the simple point is, parents who let their children manipulate them are setting those kids up. It'll only get worse, because they're allowing them to use their patterns of behavior. These are the things that every believer has, and because he's had them, he is in some ways set up with an internal ally. The problem is that temptation always, James says, has its initial effectiveness from within. He says we're tempted when we're carried away and enticed by our own lust. Now, I don't believe that he is denying here the reality of external persons or forces as a present reality or even a mitigating circumstance. I think that it's very real what people are able to, and what Satan is able to do, what the devil is able, how he's able to deceive, how people are able to leverage pressure in order to try to persuade us to do things that we really want to do, we just are a little afraid to do. I'm not minimizing that fact. It's there. Paul talks about lest you be tempted by Satan from the purity of your devotion to Christ. So there is that external factor, but James is saying, if it weren't for what's already inside, that wouldn't make that big a difference. It's what's inside that creates the real problem. And so this evening we want to look at some of these issues that find an inner core appeal within us. The reason that God is untemptable is that evil has no appeal in his character. It doesn't find any resonance in his character to bounce off of. The reason it's effective with us is because we do. Our heritage is an Adamic heritage, and we still have a residue of that Adamic heritage at every level of our growth in Christ. We still have it. So the real problem is within us. The external person and the external forces are only secondary in importance. And what I mean by secondary is this. For example, James, in this book, God holds teachers as having a more significant level of accountability. Verse 1 of chapter 3, we shall incur stricter judgment. All right, that's true. And I'm going to be held accountable for the things that I've taught people and the influence that I've wielded in my teaching upon them. But it's not going to be a primary accountability. It's going to be a secondary accountability. Because every one of us is personally first accountable to God. It's not a secondary accountability. Nobody is going to be able to stand before God and say, but my priest or my pastor or my rabbi or whatever told me this was the truth. Oh, they can say that, but isn't going to get them off the hook. Now, it will enhance the judgment upon that priest, or rabbi, or pope, whatever. He's going to have a secondary accountability, and it's going to cost him. But we all have a primary, personal, one-on-one responsibility before God, without escape. So what I want to do this evening is I want to deal with internal seduction. And there are a lot of things on this page right here that I want to deal with. There are many factors that allow temptation or weight it in the direction of success. In the first place, he says in verse 14 that we're enticed by our own lust. That word translated lust, the translation is prejudicial because the word simply means to have a strong desire. And strong desires are not in and of themselves a bad thing. They're actually built right into the makeup of man before Genesis 3. Jesus even used this word translated lust here when he said, I have had strong desire to have this final meal with you. He wasn't talking about lust in the negative sense of that term. He's simply talking about how powerful our internal desires, drives are. Now, because God created man as a creature, he is never going to escape these powerful internal appetites, drives, because he's a creature, which means he's always going to be subject to neediness. And if it weren't for the desire, the strong appetite, the need might be ignored to the detriment of the individual, even to his death. That's the problem with leprosy. There's no pain sensors because leprosy's killed them, and therefore you destroy your body by not recognizing how badly you're injuring yourself simply because there's no built-in need to back off, which pain creates. So God made us with these powerful drivers built into us. And one of the things that makes temptation effective is that we discount the power. And I should have put appetite instead of lust because it's not just lust that's a powerful driver. We have a fundamental built-in need for pleasure as opposed to pain, for the health of the body. We have a built-in fundamental need for a sense of security to keep the soul from living in panic and emotional turmoil. And we have a fundamental built-in need to be important to somebody. That's the spirit. That's what God created the spirit with that. Now, those needs were there before Genesis 3, and they're there now. The problem is the satisfaction of those appetites has been so distorted for so long in the human race that we find ourselves constantly being torn by what we ought to do when these needs surface. One of the things that we do, invariably, is discount their power and say, I can handle this. You can't. The scripture says the only way you'll escape doing the lusts of the flesh is by walking in the Spirit of God. The times when we think, well, I don't really need to be filled with the Spirit. I don't need to walk in the Spirit. I can handle this. Are the times when you're not handling it. Because it's not true. You can't do it. And the whole issue of walking by the Spirit or being filled with the Spirit is a fundamental thing that I think most of us lose sight of way too often because we discount the power. We all think that we can handle this or that or whatever in terms of our appetites, but not without the Spirit you can't. You'll mishandle it every time. One of the second things that makes temptation effective is that we believe that desire equals need. And when we believe that, we're set up to fail. And the reason why I say that is the difference between need and appetite or desire is simply you can decide need on the basis of whether it's critical in order for life to continue. For example, you have a real need for a regular intake of moisture, liquid, or you'll die. You have a real need for a continual, periodic intake of food, or you'll die. You have a real need for some levels of protection from the environment, you know, clothes and that kind of stuff, or you'll die. You have to have a certain level in order for your physical life to be sustainable. Those are needs. Anything beyond the basics is simply a desire. And it's not necessarily bad, but it has to be identified. It is not a need. We're into one of the most over-sexed generations in the world. Well, maybe not, but it seems like it. And we talk about our sexuality as though it's totally uncontrollable. It's just not true. It is, apart from the Spirit, because apart from the Spirit, God turns them over to their lust of their heart to defile their bodies among themselves. But the reason is because they've abandoned God. If they hadn't abandoned Him, it wouldn't be a deal they couldn't deal with. What I'm trying to say is one of our biggest problems is identifying need. I listen to Larry Burkett, and I don't have a lot of criticism to level, but I do have this one. He is constantly telling people that they need to have enough life insurance to cover I don't know how many years of their life based on their current. That is not a need. It is not. If God can't take care of you when your job collapses and you didn't have all this stuff, or if your spouse drops dead and they happen to be the breadwinner, then what kind of a God do you have? Now, I'm not saying by that you don't exercise prudence and all that, but you do it understanding the difference between need and desire. And as long as we believe that desire is the same thing as need, we're hooked. There's no way we'll be able to back out of some of these situations that we find ourselves being tempted in. The next thing is, and I find this in being attacked from inside the church as well as outside the church, that there is no real sufficiency in God Himself. Now, I need to be clear on what I mean by that. I read an article in Christianity Astray this month in which they had a psychologist write this article on how Spirit-filled Christians can have emotional difficulties. And he used Elijah and that great English preacher and Martin Luther and two or three others who had serious depression periods in their life. And he thought he'd proved his point. He didn't prove that they were filled with the Spirit when they were going through that kind of stuff. All he proved was that Christians can have those kind of episodes. He didn't. The thing that runs so counter is the Bible says the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace. If you walk in the Spirit, that will be your emotional experience. So, how do you get into all these emotional problems while you have love, joy, and peace? You only get into them after you've left. Now, I realize that that puts the onus on us, because when I'm depressed, the last thing I want to hear is, it's my fault, but it is. The last thing I want to hear is, my relationship with God's not what it ought to be. But that's the truth. I have had emotional upheavals that as soon as I recognize this is not the fruit of the Spirit, turned in repentance toward God and asked Him to fill me with His Spirit and deal with this in a proper way. I've had that kind of turnaround, and I think that's available to anybody that's willing to believe Him. So I'm not trying to be hard on people that have episodes of depression, all that, but I do want you to realize that that's a position that comes out of not believing that God is sufficient. And we're being attacked at every level in the United States on this, the sufficiency issues. Now, this does not mean that fellowship with God is all we need. Fellowship with God will not put food in your stomach. It will not enable you to drink water. Fellowship with God will meet your emotional need for security. It will meet your spirit's need for significance, but your bodily appetites will go without unless. But my point is, God made certain promises about people who fellowship with him. He said, if you seek my kingdom and my righteousness, I'll take care of what you need to eat and drink and wear and so on. Well, now, if he doesn't take care of it, then who dropped the ball? The first fundamental of the law of faith is what Abraham discovered, and that is, he who made the promise is obligated to keep it. So if God made the promise, it's up to him to keep it. All I'm supposed to do is stay there with him in the light. Now, somebody's going to say, well, Jesus was always fellowshipping with God, and he starved for 40 days and 40 nights. He didn't starve. He didn't die. Well, sure, he was hungry. But his needs are not going unmet unless he dies. And he knew that. One of the things that we have to do is limit ourselves to how far in the future we're going to look. If I don't eat this, I'm going to die. You can say that at the last point where you're going to die if you don't eat it. But defining need and desire, Jesus knew there were some more important things than simply feeding his body. And when he continued in his confidence in his Father, that a legitimate father wouldn't give him a stone to eat if that's, you know, if he needed bread. When he continued operating on that, guess what the father did? He sent some angels with some angel food cake. Angel food for Jesus. And he fed him. Jesus didn't die. So my point is simply, if we walk in the light, he's made certain physical level provision promises for us. He's made certain emotional, soul issue related promises for us, and he's made certain promises about the needs of our spirit, and it's up to him to keep them if we're walking with him in the light. So, we're in the light, or we wouldn't be being tempted. Temptation's design is to break us, and one of the things that it does is it attempts to break us at this point. God is not enough. That's exactly what Satan said in the garden. Yea, hath God said. Implication, God's not as good as he's cracked up to be. You need to get a little space between you and him, take care of yourself, because he might do you dirty. And that suggestion took root. But it was a lie. And then fourthly, we're prejudiced to lose if we believe it's okay to do any one of these four things. If we believe it's okay to have a divided heart, what I mean by that is that you're not committed to what God's committed to in terms of his agenda. There can only be one effective agenda, and that's his or yours. You can't go both ways. You can't serve two masters. You got to decide what you're going to do. And that's why Romans 12:1 is in the Bible. It's a summons to a singleness of heart. This is my objective in my life in this world, and this is the only objective I have. And according to Romans 8, that's being conformed to the image of Jesus, because that's God's objective for us. We cannot have a divided heart and succeed against temptation. We cannot have an ignorant mind. You're to be renewed by the transformation of your mind. People who deliberately stay out of the Scriptures and away from the teaching of the Scriptures are setting themselves up to fail. God will not support the pursuit of an ignorant mind. He will not. I had one guy tell me, I don't want to learn all that stuff because then I'll be responsible. I said, sorry, you're already responsible. Now you better start learning because you're going to be held accountable. And then thirdly, you can't believe that it's okay to have a split soul, a dual soul. That's what verse 8 in chapter 1 of James is talking about. And what I mean by that, the soul is looking for some place to rest its cause, a faith base. And a divided soul simply means, well, I'll trust God and I'll have two or three spare tires in case God fails. Well, that's a divided soul. Your commitment to God must be, if God fails, I'm hung, because that's all I'm going to trust. If he doesn't get me there, I'm not going to be there. If he can't make it for me, I'm not going to have it. And then finally, you can't believe it's okay to have a spirit of independence. God never intended for us to be independent of him. And as long as we think, well, you know,
God probably won't be too upset if I do. Forget it. He's already upset. And you're already in trouble. That spirit of independence will cause you to fail. And then fifthly, believing that self-indulgence is not a problem. It is. Our moderation is to be known in every area to all people. In other words, we're supposed to be people of moderation, which means that we don't deliberately engage in self-indulgence as a pattern. Now, why is that so? Well, let me say it this way. Needs are magnified by denial and minimized by satisfaction. If you're thirsty and you refuse to drink, you'll just get thirstier. But if you're thirsty and you drink, then you won't be as thirsty. Needs, real needs, are magnified by denial when you refuse to satisfy them, but they're minimized when you satisfy them. That's need. But desires are exactly the opposite. Desires are magnified by satisfaction and minimized by denial. The more you engage in desires, the more they become a dominant control over you. So when you satisfy desires, you're only magnifying those desires. When you deny those desires, then they lose their ability to dominate you. They're minimized by denial. That's the difference between need and desire. It's not wrong to give in to desires as long as it's not a pattern of self-indulgence, because the pattern is what sets you up down the road. And this can happen in any area of our life where we have appetites that move beyond need to simply desire. When we move into the area of desire, we have to be very careful that we're not being self-indulgent, because if we are, we're digging ourselves a hole. It'll be hard to break it. I had a friend who came to Christ. When she came to Christ, she was a heavy smoker. And she was sitting at her desk smoking one day, and the Lord said to her heart, "I'm going to deliver you from your cigarette habit now." She says, "I had to take one more puff." And she said it made a difference. It made it more difficult. But she put the cigarette out, and she threw her cigarettes away, and she was done. And she really didn't have any problem doing that. But at a later point in her Christian experience, not too much later, but several months down the road, she got into a pressure situation, and she had this pattern of learned behavior about how you handle pressure situations, and she used to handle them with cigarettes. So she went out and got her a pack of cigarettes. She said, "I quit so easy the first time, I thought I wouldn't have any trouble the second time." Well, the thing she forgot was that God delivered her the first time. And he doesn't make a habit of making it easy for us to continue to sin without consequences. And so the second time that she tried to quit was tough. God gave her grace to do it, but it was more of a struggle, much more of a struggle. And the whole problem there was this self-indulgence. She had succumbed when she should have stood firm against temptation. So verse 14 is simply pointing the finger to the real truth that we're going to have to deal with temptation by dealing with the appetites that come from within. And we do those partly by recognizing these factors, but more by, is it 2 Peter chapter 1? I want you to look at 2 Peter chapter 1 real quick, and then we're through. Look at verse 4. 2 Peter 1:4. "By these he has granted to us his precious and magnificent promises, in order that by them," that is, by these precious and magnificent promises, "you might become partakers of the divine nature." So you become a partaker of the divine nature by believing the promises, having escaped the corruption that is in the world by lust. So our basic defense against temptation that comes from our own lust is believing what God has already said, the promises. And then being aware, too, of the things that can cause us to be predisposed to giving in. Any one of these five things I had on the overhead. So, James is simply
insisting in verse 14 that we take responsibility. The temptation problem is our problem, comes from within us. But that doesn't mean that God's not willing to deal with us and help us. It simply wants us to recognize where it's coming from. Okay? Any questions or comments before we quit?